Thank you again so much for the opportunity to be here with you all and on this subject. We're going to spend most of this evening in Daniel chapter 3, but right before we get there, we're going to go to Hosea chapter 3 for just a moment. Hosea chapter 3. We talked this morning about how you get the problem with inaccurate Bibles because they're translated from the wrong text. There is another problem where you have trouble with scriptures because God gave the scriptures, originally the Old Testament in Hebrew, except for a little bit of Daniel, which is in Aramaic, and the New Testament in Greek. And many times there's a Hebrew or Aramaic or Greek word that could have several possible translations in English linguistically. Okay. But only one of them is going to be right in terms of the Bible. It has to fit the context of the passage in order to have it make sense. For example, Hosea chapter 3, verse 1. Then said the Lord unto me, go yet love a woman beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress, according to the love of the Lord toward the children of Israel, who look to other gods and love flagons of wine. That Hebrew word that gets translated flagons of wine is a word that simply means the fruit of the vine. The word itself can mean, refer to any fruit of the vine. It can be grape juice, it can be fig juice, it can be date juice, it can be raisins, which comes as the fruit of the vine. And so when a Bible translator's right there, he has to make a decision about which one of those it is. Now, this is condemned. Israel is in trouble for having this fruit of the vine. So what do you figure the context of that is? Do you think Israel's in trouble because they're drinking grape juice? Or because they have dates or figs or raisins? What is it that you think creates the problem? Loving wine. That just makes sense. That is the translation the King James translators put there for good reason. But most modern English Bibles do not have flagons of wine there. It says in most modern English Bibles, raisins. You all understand the terrible trouble we've had with raisins. All the car accidents caused by over-raisin eating. The men who destroy their families by cashing their paycheck on Friday, rushing right to the grocery store, buying box after box of raisins. All the counseling the pastor has to do because of homes that have been injured by raisin use. Some churches even have specialized programs for raisin addicts. You knew that, right? The obvious, sensible translation here is flagons of wine. It's wine. We're talking about wine. Wine is that which has a danger to it that creates all these problems. No other fruit of the vine creates something that needs to be condemned by God. So why do all these translations put raisins there? I said, but it could be one of the translations, not in that context. Why is it so important to them to have God condemning raisins there? The answer is they're just looking for a chance to be different than the King James Bible and correct the King James Bible because the concept of a perfect translation bothers them because it creates an authority that is completely over them. I was preaching on this same subject up at Bible Baptist Church in Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska, and the pastor had put a gift basket in the motel room, as some churches do. And in the gift basket, there was a box of raisins. And so I had translations from six other English Bibles, all of which condemn raisins here. And so I read those translations, one after another, after another. I said, would you look and see what your very pastor put in my room? And I held up a box of raisins. I said, seriously, you folks should be having a business meeting after the service tonight. And everybody laughed. What do you think would have happened if there'd been a bottle of wine in that basket and I'd held that up that night and say, you folks got a problem. Look what your pastor put in my gift basket. Raisins is a nonsense, idiotic, stupid translation that is used over and over and over again in modern English Bibles. Okay. By the way, it even reads that way in the New King James Bible. I get a lot of questions after the message I preached this morning often about the New King James because I talked about Bibles that are translated from the critical text and they're not being accurate, when the truth is much of the time the New King James is not translated from the critical text. Just a little bit. And this is my answer. But so, well, they say it doesn't have all these errors that the other Bibles do, and that is true. But here's the answer I give about that. Why I have a problem with it. If you put out in front of me, say we're having supper after service tonight, and you put out, say we're having a church dinner, and there's three different kinds of chili you could have at the church dinner. One of them, perfect, grade A, popular chili, we have it all the time. The second bowl of chili has a little bit of arsenic in it. And the third bowl of chili is chock full of arsenic. Which one do you think I'm picking? Let's say you make this offer to me 10 times. How many times do you think I'm picking the first one? 10 times? I don't want any corruption in my Bible. Every word matters to me. Now, go with me to Daniel chapter 3, and we're going to do a little exercise in this business of picking words. And principle is called polysemy. And we're talking about a polysemic translation or polysemous translation. And it's the idea that the translator has to pick from several possibilities. And I will tell you the context of the passage always makes it clear what you need to pick. But for example, there is the word Elohim. It is both in Hebrew and Aramaic. It is the word for God, for the Creator God. But the word Elohim can also have other meanings. It can mean, be translated accurately, God. In some places in the Bible, it's translated gods because it refers to the pagan gods. And in some places, it actually refers to as a human judge. And when you have different meanings, they always have something in common. That went through me for a while, except I finally figured that out. A human judge is someone who thinks they're God in their courtroom. Elohim can mean God, gods, or judges. And we're going to go to this passage, and there's several places in Daniel chapter 3 where the word Elohim is used. So when I'm reading the passage, I'm simply going to read it, and when I get to that word, instead of reading the English translation, I'm going to read Elohim. And then I'm going to ask you to tell me which one of the three it should be in that place based on the context. Okay? And no cheating. This has all been done for you already in the King James Bible. But you tonight are going to be the translation committee for Daniel chapter 3. So you know the story. Nebuchadnezzar erected a golden image. Secular history tells us about that and tells us he made it to look like him. And all these young men are there. He had gathered young men, bright, intelligent young men from all the countries he'd captured. He brought them in to train a class of government servants. He brought them from all over the world that he had conquered, and they're not supposed to have any loyalty at any country or any religion or any loyalty to anything but Nebuchadnezzar. And he's erected this golden image, and the message was when they played the music, everybody was to bow and worship the golden image. This was not such a big challenge for most of these folks. They came from countries with 5 gods or 10 gods or 200 gods. So worshiping another god is not really a big deal, especially when you consider the alternative. If you did not at this moment show this act of tribute towards Nebuchadnezzar and his gods, you got put in a burning, fiery furnace. Pretty serious price tag. So if you're from Elam or you're from wherever and you say, well, I've been worshiping 6 gods my whole life, burning, fiery furnace, I think I'll worship 7. Okay, man, it's just not a problem. There was one group for whom it was a problem because only one of the countries he conquered worshipped one God, the Creator God, the God of the Bible, the God of the Jews, whatever terminology you want to use. They only had one God, and they're forbidden to worship any other God. Many of them bowed. I'm sure as they kneeled, they were saying, God, forgive me. I don't want to do this. I don't want to be part of it. But you've seen what the punishment is, Lord. You know I don't have any choice. But three of them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, don't bow. Okay? Very common Sunday school story. Y'all know the story. That's where we're going to pick up right at that point. And we're going to pick up and verse 12. And some of Nebuchadnezzar's officials have come to him and explained to him there's a problem. Verse 12 says, there are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee, nor served thy Elohim, nor worshipped the golden image thou hast set up. God, gods, or judges? Gods, okay, how do we know? It's Nebuchadnezzar's Elohim. Those are the gods, and this word is translated gods all over the Old Testament. Those are Nebuchadnezzar's gods. So Elohim there gets translated gods. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do not ye serve my Elohim, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? How do we translate Elohim here? Gods. How do we know? It's Nebuchadnezzar's Elohim. It is the gods of Babylon. Context makes that pretty simple. Verse 15. Now, if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, all kinds of contemporary Christian music. I'm sorry, that was me adding to the Bible there. Ye fall down and worship the image which I have made well. But if you worship not, he shall be cast the same hour in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that Elohim that shall deliver you out of my hands? God, because it's the Elohim of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Okay? It's the God of the Bible, God of the Jews, Creator God. Okay. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we're not careful to answer thee in this manner. If it be so, our Elohim, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. How do we translate Elohim in this verse? God, Creator God again, because it's the Elohim of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Okay. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, we will not serve thy Elohim, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. How do we translate Elohim here? Gods, because it's Nebuchadnezzar's Elohim. And was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded them they should heat the furnace one seven times more than it was wont to be heated. According to secular history, the burning fiery furnace in Babylon was a pit, large pit in the ground. It was lined with in the walls all the way around and on the floor with rock that radiated heat. And they'd put combustible material in it, set it on fire, and the walls and the floor were radiating heat. And then you dropped a person in there, and literally it would roast them to death. But before they roasted, before they died, they would be trying, it's a natural reflex to try and pull away from the heat. And so they'd pull, they'd jump, they'd move, so forth, and they'd all laugh at them as they were being roasted by the firing furnace. He's angry. He says, I want seven times more heat in there than you normally have. So they're throwing the stuff in to set it on fire. It no doubt has everybody gathered around it. The whole point is to send a message to everybody, you do not defy Nebuchadnezzar. He commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them in the burning fire furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I mean, they got such a booming fire in that pit now, the men who take Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego up to the edge of the pit to throw them in, the flames are so high and so hot that the men who take them to the edge to throw them in are killed by the flames. Verse 23. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fire furnace. So they're all watching them, waiting to see them do this dance as they roast to death. And Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished, rose up in haste and spake, and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, true, O king, I love this question. Didn't we throw three men in? He answered and said, lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the son of Elohim. How are you going to translate that? God? Y'all saying God? Then why in virtually every Bible translation in the world is it translated a son of the gods? Including the RSV and the NIV, and the New King James doesn't get this one wrong, but virtually every other English translation gets it wrong. So he looks out and he says, well, the form of the fourth, he looks like a son of the gods. Seriously? Does that make any sense here? Do you think Nebuchadnezzar thinks he just won this? What a moment. People say, well, he had to be son of the gods because there's no way Nebuchadnezzar could ever have heard about the son of God. I said, really? We don't know where Daniel was on this event, but Daniel was close in the government to Nebuchadnezzar. You don't suppose Daniel ever got around to mentioning it. Psalm 2, kiss the son. Or Isaiah 7, which tells us that he is the son and the father both. How's that? How about Proverbs 30, when the Lord, in order to humble man, asks him two questions. What is God's name and what is his son's name? You don't suppose Daniel might ever have mentioned any of that in any of his discussions with Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar just dismissed it as nothing until all of a sudden at this moment he sees the fourth person. He's walking in the fire with the other three. They are not hurt, and there's something about him that looks different, and it clicks. He said, it's the Son of God. He's real. And there he is in the fire. By the way, can you imagine what a moment that was for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? I've heard this. I've heard it all my life. And more lately, I'm experiencing it. They say when you get older, all of your memories sort of grow and get bigger. And I'm starting to get that, you know. And I get with the friends of my youth. Some of them are gone already. But I get with the friends of my youth, and we're swapping stories from 40, 50 years ago, and I have a feeling those stories have grown over the 40 or 50 years. How would you like to be Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego running into each other 40 years later? And he says, you remember what it was like that day we were in the fire? And Jesus came and walked with us and talked with us, and the fire didn't touch us. How do you make that story any bigger than it is? How do you exaggerate that story? I mean, what a moment. So why do all these Bibles, not just English, this is a problem all over the world in every language, it is incredible the number of Bibles that say a son of the gods right here. Which is an absolutely nonsense translation. It is as much nonsense as raisins instead of wine, but it's more significant. Why would they do this? I mean, the Jehovah's Witness Bible says a son of the gods. Why would the Jehovah's Witnesses translate that way? Well, let's see. They don't believe Jesus was God. What happens if they put Jesus in the Old Testament and call him God? They just destroyed the whole Jehovah's Witness religion. So they're going to call the son of the gods. English translation after translation after translation that are being carried by Bible-believing Baptists to their churches that don't know any better. They are carrying translations that were translated by modernists who don't believe that Jesus was God. And so they cannot admit he was in the Old Testament era appearing in the fire as God when they don't believe he was ever God. Modernists cannot translate this verse accurately, because if they did, it would destroy their entire religious faith. And so you have a problem when instead of being bound by the Word of God, you're trying to fix it. And I promise you, all over the place tonight, there are independent Baptists carrying Bibles that mess this verse up. And I don't just mean in English. There's a problem in the most popular French translation. There's a problem in the most popular Spanish translation. And you can go from language to language to language with Bibles that have been translated by modernists, and they mess this verse up. Somebody asked me about a Bible translation or a translation project. Say, should we support this? The very first question I ask is, how do they translate? How does this Bible translate Daniel 3:25? If they translate it Son of God, they're going to be mocked by most of the people in the intellectual, scholarly, so forth business. But that means they want an accurate translation. And if they don't, then they have an inaccurate translation, and I don't trust the rest of what they do. I give you an example. I've ended up writing and talking about and dealing with this subject a fair amount. I really never planned for that. It just sort of happened to me. But a fellow shows up, the church I'm pastoring in Chicago, one day he's from the Philippines. I go to the Philippines all the time. This will be the first January in 25 years I have not gone to the Philippines, and that's because they're not allowing people in. But I spent a lot of time in the Philippines. I have Filipino visitors at various times, and I know one time I was in a church in the Philippines joking. I was pastoring in Chicago. I said, I'm just here on visitation. I said, when you all move to Chicago, which you know you're going to do because there's tons of Filipino people in Chicago, I said, you've got to come to our church. About a year later, Filipino family of four walks in. They said, we're here. They just moved to Chicago. It's great. So I'd tell the church I was on visitation when I would go over there. This guy comes in, he says, can I talk with you after church? I never met him. I said, sure. He said, I've done a translation, a new translation in the Ilocano language, because the translation our people are using is corrupt. Now, most of the people there speak English, but he thought it was important they have a translation in and I believe there should be a good translation of the Bible in every language of the world. And so he sat down to talk to me and tell me he was trying to do a genuine, serious, accurate translation. Here's question number one. How'd you translate Daniel 3:25? He smiled and said, the Son of God. I said, okay, we got something to talk about now. Let's get on. And by the way, today his translation is in Ilocano and being used by people all over the place there. But that was the first question I always ask. The second question is, do you have 1 John 5:7 in this Bible? And if they tell me they don't, they don't pass those two tests, I don't even need to talk to them anymore. Don't need to waste anybody's time. I'm not supporting it in this language or another language. Why would they ruin this wonderful, beautiful, significant verse when the obvious translation is right in front of you and you all got it? Now let's just go on just a little bit. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High Elohim, come forth and come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth of the midst of the fire. God, gods, or judges? God, the Most High Elohim. Everybody in this room can figure that out. So why is it there so many people who are Bible translators that can't? It's telling you it matters who translates the Bible and what method they use. Princes, governors, and captains, king's counselors, being gathered together, saw those men upon whose bodies the fire had no power. They That fire hadn't touched them even in the least little bit, even though they were in the midst of it. Nor was an hair of their head singed. They hadn't lost a hair. Neither were their coats changed. The clothes they were wearing was not affected by the fire. Nor the smell of fire had passed on them. They didn't even smell like smoke. And she puts them a step above some of the people I pastored in Chicago. I used to tell our folks, I said, I don't hate Christians that smoke. I will be your pastor. I'll love you anyway. In fact, I'll be there to visit you when you're in the hospital. I said, in fact, I'll probably visit you more than I do other people. I'll be there to preach your funeral probably sooner than other people's. They didn't even smell like smoke. Then Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said, "Blessed be the Elohim of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any Elohim except their own Elohim." Now the word's three times in this verse. So let's go through. First one. Blessed be the Elohim of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. God, you're not cheating, are you? But by the way, isn't it marvelous that this is already done for you for every single word in the Bible, so I don't have to look it up and figure it out. It has been done for us already. That they might not serve nor worship any Elohim. That's kind of a generic use of the word there. So the King James translators put it down as God, but with a small g. Except their own Elohim, God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, except their own God. It's the God of the Bible. Therefore, I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the Elohim of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other Elohim that can deliver after this sort. Gods, judges. No, it's God. By the way, some people say, I've had people say, "Dr. Stringer, you make too much of this." You think I make too much of it? You want to see what Nebuchadnezzar did? He made a rule. You speak against this Elohim that we just saw. So here's what happens to you. You'll be cut in pieces, and your house will be turned into a dunghill. Because they would carry wagon loads of dung every day outside of Babylon, but he said, instead of carrying it all down, we'll take this house and we'll dump it there. Now, according to secular history, the priests of the gods, Baal and Molech and all that, there was a region in which they all lived together, and there was a street, and there were houses and mansions, really, of the false teachers, worship false gods. So what happens if one of them gets up and says something against the true God? Pretty soon, people are going down that street saying, "What is that smell?" And it's priest so-and-so's house. I say, "Why doesn't he do something about that smell?" And I say, "He can't. He's cut in half. And for the last few days, every dung wagon, instead of going out of the city, has come to his mansion. The dung has been dumped there so that everybody would understand he spoke a word against the Elohim of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." You think I make a big deal out of this? You look what Nebuchadnezzar did. Because this is a big deal. And I've heard so many people offer excuses, we'll say, about why they have a bad translation there, especially other language Bibles. And again, the most popular French Bible has this wrong. The most popular Spanish Bible has it wrong. And many other languages. And they try to make excuses for it. I say, look, it just says that because there's people who want it to say that. because they don't believe the truth about Jesus. And if they recognize and acknowledge that Jesus, the Son of God, back in Daniel's day came and appeared and was in a burning fiery furnace, it destroys their entire religion. We had a Muslim lady saved when I was in Chicago, and whenever anybody saved, I'd give them a Bible. I'd tell them to read their Bible every day. I said, don't worry about it if you don't understand it all. That's not really a problem. None of us do. Keep reading it every day till something's a blessing. Okay? And I said, if there's something bothering you you don't understand, call the pastor. Okay? This lady lived on the same block as the Chicago Seminary, which was the first liberal Baptist seminary in the United States, first seminary to go liberal. They don't believe any of the fundamentals of the Christian faith. Lady calls me one day. She says, Pastor, I hate to bother you, but she said, I have a question. I'm afraid it's a silly question. I said, ma'am, there is no such thing as a silly question when you've been saved for 2 weeks. She said, well, I thought I read something in the Bible. And I said, that just can't be true, but I think I just read it again. She said, is Jesus coming back? See, you grew up with that. She grew up Muslim. She never heard that before. First time she ever heard that, she read it in the Bible, and she said, well, I must have misunderstood that. That can't be right. And she just come across another passage that said, Jesus is coming back. She says, Jesus coming back? I said, yes, he is. I said, not only did you read that right, I said, you're the best theologian on your block. Because you just believed what the Bible said, rather than coming up with an explanation and excuse for it. She was the best theologian on her block. Only reason that changed is because she moved off that block. But she was the best theologian on her block. See, a lot of folks have been misled on this. They love the Lord. They love the Bible. They want to have the truth. But they do not understand the issue that we're actually facing in terms of all this. It matters who translate your Bible. Do you trust the Jehovah's Witness Bible? They have their own translation. Just out of curiosity, do you trust the Jehovah's Witness Bible? What would you figure the Jehovah's Witnesses would do with their Bible? They would take some things out. They would change some things. Because if they leave it the way it's supposed to be, it ruins their religion. So they're going to change it. Now, I'm going to tell you something. Jehovah's Witness Bible is translated from the same critical text that your RSV is translated from, your NIV is translated from, your New American Standard Bible is translated from, the ESV, which is the most popular Bible of the moment, is translated from. They all, in passage after passage, match the Jehovah's Witness Bible. You want to know what doesn't match the Jehovah's Witness Bible? You want to know what Bible the Jehovah's Witnesses have been trained when they are at your door to tell you is inaccurate and incorrect? And they will tell you in a hurry that all these other translations match their Bible. And I've had people come to me and say, the Jehovah's Witnesses at my door, and they said, this all matched their Bible. And I know that's not true. I said, you better slow down a little bit, because it is true in most cases. Because they're translated from the same corrupt text. I don't trust the Jehovah's Witness translators. I do not trust the modernist translators, the Protestant, Christian, quote-unquote, modernist translators. They cannot translate the Bible accurately, because if they did, it would destroy their religion. So what are they going to do? They're going to change some stuff. Now, let me tell you what you have in many of these modern English Bibles. They had a group of men working on this passage, men working on this passage, men working on this passage. Not very many of them. They're not doing it full time. They're not at it for 7 years. They're being paid by a publishing house to do this, and they're under deadlines. Sometimes some of the passages in there are translated correctly, depending on who's doing that section. And somebody gets it, they read it, and they say, well, my heart was really blessed by this. Here it is. And they have a passage that is translated correctly. And so the truth transfers. But you won't get through the whole Bible that way. Again and again and again. You make a better Bible translation committee than modernist scholars with PhDs behind their name who teach full-time at seminaries, who are desperate to protect their doctrine. And so they play games with Bible translation to protect their doctrine. It makes them feel very important to say, a better translation would be, so let's say a better translation, Hosea 3:1, would be raisins. So anytime, pastor, you want to preach a sermon against raisins, just get one of those Bibles, because there it is, right there. And then you can preach it. And it makes them feel scholarly and educated because they've risen above the King James Bible in their understanding. Again, it's what I call the tyranny of the experts. This is what all the smart people believe. This is what all the educated people believe. This is what all the really trained people believe. Really? It matters who translates your Bible. And these kind of mistakes in modern English Bibles are not just in a place or two. That would be serious if they were in one or two places. They are all over the place. We had a young man saved at church in Chicago. He was a policeman on the south side of Chicago, the war zone. He was quite a character, well known. He just did wild things going after bad guys. He literally, some guys were robbing a bank. The robbery went wrong. They had come out of the bank. They'd gotten in the getaway car, and he got there. And there was a door open on the getaway car as they were starting to pull away, and he jumped in the car, went off with them. I mean, it was something. Kind of stuff you hear about on TV, but doesn't normally happen in real life, you know. And his wife got really concerned something was going to happen to him, and she said, you know, we need to go to church. So they came to church, and they got saved, baptized, and doing great. And then after few months, he says, pastor, I need to talk to you after the service. Okay. He said, pastor, he said, you lied to me. I said, excuse me? He said, you lied to me. You told me when I got saved that salvation was eternal and you can't lose your salvation. But he said, right here in my Bible, and he's got a list of verses, he says, it says you can. He starts going to these verses. I said, wait a minute. Tell me what translation you're using. You're not using the King James Bible I gave you. He told me what translation they were using. And in that Bible, in every one of those verses, it taught you could lose your salvation. It matters what Bible you have in front of you. Okay. By the way, this is just an interesting thing to me. The NIV, that's the Bible he had, was an NIV. NIV was translated by people who at best, some of them were outright modernists, but some of them were evangelical, but they believed you could lose your salvation. And their passage after passage, they try to make that point, you could lose your salvation. The men who translated the New King James Version were not a bunch of bad guys like some of these others. They were saved men, and they were horrified by the NIV teaching that you could lose your salvation. So they wanted to be sure that was made clear. So they did a translation for the Bible, and they made it so clear, they put eternal security in verses that it's not in. It's like they twisted all kinds of things to teach eternal security. And I'm glad they had a true doctrine, but God doesn't need that kind of help. Okay? He gives us what he gives us. It's our job to take it literally, be guided by it, be led by it, be blessed by it. It's very, very important that we have an accurate Bible. Okay? It matters so very much. I gave you one more example and I'll be done for tonight. This came out when I was in college. It was called Good News for Modern Man. And they had a program. They said, we're going to get a Good News for Modern Man Bible to every home in America. And they said, it's going to be simple and easy to understand and new and modern and relevant. And it's going to bring revival to America because every home is going to have a Bible they can understand. That was the campaign. That was the crusade. You can still find them in used bookstores, usually for 50 cents because they printed millions and they're all over the place and nobody has them or reads them or uses them today. But one of the many problems with it is from the wrong text, but it had another issue they had. They wanted to get away from the idea of the blood atonement because they said that turns people off. So every place in the Bible that talks about the blood of Christ, in Good News for Modern Man, they changed it to the death of Christ. That's just what they wanted to do. The word, the Greek word for death and the Greek word for blood are not the same word at all. But anytime they came to a passage about the blood of Christ, they changed it to the death of Christ because that's what they thought was a good idea. And while I was in Bible college, the translator of it, one-man translator, was in town. And the college said, well, why don't you come over, our chapel hour, would you be willing to come over and answer some questions about your Bible translation? So they brought him over, they let him in. They wouldn't let us students ask questions, but professors were asking questions. And I said, why did you translate the obvious word for blood as death? It's two completely different words in the Greek. And his answer was, we need to help people who are turned off by the idea of a blood atonement. That's not mine and your job. It mattered who translated that Bible, that he had that idea. Because Christ died on the cross, and his shed blood being applied to our sin so that God instead, a holy God, instead of seeing our sin, sees the blood of Jesus Christ shed for us, is not some minor little truth. It's as important as it gets. It matters who translates your Bible. Congratulations, you were a good, successful translation committee tonight.